Hello and welcome to a KABU Public Affairs special program, Focus on Israel-Palestine. I'm William Seaman, co-host with Hala Gores of One Land, Many Voices, but today I'm on my own, or not quite on my own. Our special guest today, for the next half hour, is a media and public affairs strategist who is currently advising the new pro-Israel lobbying organization, J Street. He's a board member of Americans for Peace Now. His most recent book, just out from Potomac Books, is Transforming America's Israel Lobby, The Limits of Its Power and the Potential for Change. He writes for the Huffington Post, the Jerusalem Report, the Forward, and the Israeli daily Haaretz. On the phone with us from New York, Mr. Dan Fleshler. Mr. Fleshler, thanks for joining us today.
Sure, you're welcome. I do need to make one correction. I'm on the advisory council of J Street. I'm one of many voices weighing in there. I think it wouldn't be right to say I advise them.
All right. Well, let me also first mention that my guest today will be speaking here in Oregon later this month on two occasions. First, on Saturday, December 19th at 7 p.m. at Congregation Neve Shalom at 2900 Southwest Peaceful Lane here in Portland. And then again on Sunday, December 20th at 6:30 p.m. at Temple Beth Israel at 1175 East 29th Avenue down in Eugene. Mr. Fleshler, Transforming America's Israel Lobby, a rather ambitious goal and title for your book. First of all, what do you have in mind when you refer to America's Israel Lobby? Is it the same lobby that John Mearsheimer and Stephen Walt describe in their book?
Well, I had some problems with their depiction of the lobby. I thought that they depicted it as this monstrous sort of octopus which had its tentacles in both the American media and the court and the American government, and I thought they exaggerated the power of the what I call the conventional Israel lobby. What I define as the conventional Israel lobby are organizations which include the American Israel Public Affairs Committee in Washington, but as well as others that want to see no distance between American positions and official Israeli positions, that are loath to criticize the Israeli occupation, and tend to lean hard on American Jews in particular who are critical of Israeli policies. That's how I would define the conventional pro-Israel lobby. I think there are other lobbies in the American Jewish community which also are trying to have an impact on Washington and on American policy, and they tend not to get taken as seriously by people in the corridors of power.
Now, you sort of hinted at that in your answer, but what other issues prompted you to write this book?
Well, look, I've been for years both professionally and personally working on behalf of the organizations you mentioned in your introduction, organizations that support the peace camp in Israel. And for years I've heard that polls showed that when compared with the conventional Israel lobby, American Jews are much more unhappy with the occupation, much more opposed to settlement expansion, and more open to territorial compromise. And yet, in the minds of people in Washington, the political elite, the only American Jews of political consequence were those that tended to be represented by the right wing of our community. So I embarked on a quest starting 3 years ago to find out, why is this the case? Why have the American Jewish doves been so silent all of these years? Why has the conventional Israel lobby maintained the extent of power that they've maintained? And most importantly, what can be done about it? What can be done to build what I call a lobby for the rest of us, an effective political bloc of Americans who see no contradiction between being pro-Israeli, pro-Palestinian, and pro-American? A lobby of people who want American policy to be much more balanced and even-handed in its approach to the conflict. And so all of those tasks were on my mind as I embarked on both the research and the writing of this book.
Now, you describe J Street as a pro-Israel lobby, and I'm assuming J Street is what you're hoping is going to evolve into an organization that can represent this part of the Jewish community that is not currently represented by the conventional Israel lobby, as you've described it. But when you say pro-Israel, what do you have in mind? I know that there are a series of concrete questions that often delineate what people think of as being pro-Israel or anti-Israel, but what do you have in mind when you say pro-Israel?
Well, I think it's pro-Israel to try one's best to end an occupation that has been a strategic and a moral disaster for Israel and the Israeli people. So pro-Israel means trying to find a solution to the Israeli-Palestinian conflict that enables the Palestinian people to exercise their aspirations of self-determination and enables the Israeli people to live in peace side by side with the Palestinian state. Now, I've been doing a little bit of research on you, Mr. Seaman, and I know that you tend to be I've been told you tend to be a one-stater. So I don't know how you came to that conclusion. I believe that a two-state solution is the only way out of the mess that the Israeli and Palestinian people are in, and that every effort should be made to get to the point where the two peoples are ready to live side by side in peace. And that's what a pro-Israel American foreign policy would be, and that's what a pro-Israel American Jewish foreign policy would be. And that's where I stand.
Let me clarify. I should say that my own politics on this question are it's up to the people there to decide whether a two-state solution or a one-state solution is the right path.
Right. Well, polls will consistently show again that obviously they differ from moment to moment depending on what's going on in the region, but this is the solution that both most Israelis and most Palestinians still favor, two-state solution.
And that's fine. Well, let me actually, this is a good direction for the conversation. Is it impossible for someone who supports a one-state solution to be considered pro-Israel?
I have respect for some people who support the one-state solution. I do. When you say, is it impossible, I think that there are people who believe that it's too late for two states to occur, that the Oslo process, for whatever promise it has now been made essentially irrelevant because of the facts on the ground. So as I said, I think it's possible to not be anti-Israel if you support a one-state solution. I just think it's impractical, among other things. It may not be it may be the wrong thing to do. It may be the right thing to do. But either way, it's the impractical thing to do. And so, if one supports it, one is ultimately supporting a perpetuation of the conflict, for whatever one's intentions are. And I think a one-state solution is essentially a recipe for the kind of ethnic conflict that will make what happened in the former Yugoslavia look like a garden party. And that's why I'm opposed to it. I don't want to get into, and I assume you don't, the notion of sort of prescribing what's pro-Israel and what isn't pro-Israel among people who have ultimately the best intentions for both the Israeli people and the Palestinian people. And I just think it's the wrong road to travel on. But I also think that the two-state solution, such as it is a very, very flawed solution, and is not going to satisfy anybody very well, and is going to lead to nothing but a kind of a low-grade, low-ebb tension and conflict. But I think, as Churchill said about democracy, despite its flaws, it's the best choice we have available. It's better than anything else we have.
Well, I agree with you. I think it is a process that's rather fraught with all sorts of dangers, the notion of trying to better define pro-Israel. And yet, J Street has specifically defined itself as a pro-Israel lobby. That's why it seems to be pretty fundamental to try to unpack what are the potentials of J Street as an organization in terms of contributing in a positive way, as I think we both hope it will.
If I could interrupt. Again, it defines itself as a pro-Israel lobby. Its main target is the American Jewish community. We're talking about identity politics here. And within the framework of American Jewish organizations that I both explore and discuss in my book, J Street is among those that believe it is pro-Israel to support territorial compromise, to end the occupation, and to support a two-state solution. But its targets are not America as a whole. Its targets in terms of its political activities are American Jews. And within the American Jewish community, that's where it can have an impact.
And what prompts you, as someone who's concerned about the Palestine-Israel conflict, what prompts you to focus so exclusively on the Jewish community in this case?
Well, I don't focus exclusively on the American Jewish community. I have a whole chapter called The Shared Community, which talks about other faith groups, Muslims, Christians, church groups, of whom many agree completely with us, and some agree mostly with us. And in recent years, there's been a lot more political engagement and united political action on certain legislation in the Arab American community, the Muslim American community, and the Christian community. that is to say, united with the pro-Israel camp that I associate myself with. There are organizations like the Arab American Institute and the American Task Force on Palestine and Churches for Middle East Peace that are very close in their goals to J Street and Americans for Peace Now and B'Tzedek V'Shalom, which are the organizations I've had something to do with over the years. And there has been a kind of a coalescence of political activity. We may not agree on everything, but we agree on a great many things. And that's the kind of coalition that I want to see grow in Washington and around the country. But that said, the J Street is focused mainly because it's just a practical political organizing on the American Jewish community. That doesn't mean that, of course, it doesn't mean that other Americans don't have an important role to play in this. Of course they do. This is not Israel's problem. This is not the Palestinians' problem. This is America's problems, too. This is a problem that the world needs to deal with.
You've talked about J Street focusing on American Jews or the American Jewish community. So it's not specifically a lobby organization intent on changing the policy of the United States government, which typically the lobbying organizations located in Washington, D.C., that's their target, is to change U.S. policy on a particular issue.
On the contrary, that's just what it's focusing on. It's focusing on changing American policy in the region so that it's more balanced, it's more even-handed, and it allows for a more creative diplomacy in the region. That's the point of J Street. If there weren't that point, then there would be no reason to support it.
So in what sense were you speaking of earlier about it targeting the American Jewish community?
Yes, I was targeting, it targets the American Jewish community as a political base of support for the kinds of policies I was mentioning before, which is to say policies that are more even-handed, more balanced, and more creative and more engaged. In terms of its, in terms of the American, in terms of the peace process in the region, but the targets for political organizing are American Jews. That's true of J Street. The targets of political organizing for Churches for Middle East Peace are obviously the Christian Americans. The targets for Arab Americans and Muslim Americans are the other organizations that I suggested. But that doesn't mean that American policy, I mean, the ultimate goal has to be American policy and a change therein.
One of the dimensions of your book is, and I think you describe this in terms of your own experience, is a discussion of how difficult it is for some Jews in the United States to speak out against specific policies of the state of Israel. And I was wondering if you could talk about that struggle, both in terms of your own efforts to overcome whatever obstacles you might confront, but also more generally what you've observed in the broader Jewish community.
Well, one of the obstacles to a lobby for the rest of us is really a very pragmatic one. It's that folks on my side of the fence in the American Jewish community are not single-issue voters. We simply don't care as much about this issue as those on the right. To activists in the conventional Israel lobby, this issue is their main political focus, their mission in life. Jews who lean to the left on this issue tend to be more likely to devote their attention to the Sierra Club or to gay rights or to preserving the domestic social safety net. And Jews on the other side of the issue tend to think of this as, again, their main political cause. So one of the challenges for lobbying American Jews who agree with me has been just the need to get them off their duffs and to care more about this issue. But a related challenge has been the lack of easily justifiable, sort of simple causes to rally around. This is a very complicated business. And the Jewish peace camp here and in Israel has focused on demonstrating the necessity of compromise, but only if and when a reliable partner for peace can be found. So there's a kind of a lack of clarity, a lack of easy answers that in turn reinforces a natural tendency towards conformity, towards me-too-ism. And all of those have mitigated against American Jews getting off their chairs and getting off their duffs and doing something about, trying to do something about what is an American problem as well as an Israeli problem as well as a Palestinian problem. But I think the hesitation that has been extant in the American Jewish community has been very destructive to both Israel and to the United States and to the Palestinian people. And it's time to develop a critical path and amass an alternative political bloc that's loud enough, large enough, and frankly wealthy enough to provide a a cushion to Obama and other leaders who wanted to take a different tack in the Middle East.
Now, what policies would you want the United States to pursue if you could mobilize this part of the Jewish community to support a new set of policies? What concretely do you have in mind?
Well, I can tell you, first of all, what I would not support. So let's start with that. American engagement should not mean putting overt pressure on Israel to compromise on its core security requirements. It should not mean allowing the West Bank to be used as a staging ground for Hamas and Islamic Jihad rocket attacks on the coastal plain of Israel. It should mean insisting that the Netanyahu government keeps the promise it makes in agreements to stop settlement expansion once and for all. It should mean insisting that Palestinians, in turn, do everything possible to stop exacerbating Israeli fears that they have no partner for peace. It should mean that the U.S. president feels like he or she has the political wiggle room to suggest ideas that neither side is particularly happy with, but both sides can live with. And it should mean that if either side breaks its promises or sort of stalls the journey to peace, there will be consequences from the U.S., real penalties, not just ineffectual complaints.
What would be an example of a real penalty? For example, the reason this question is intriguing to me is that my understanding is that say, an organization like BritCitic, which I think reflects to some degree the kind of politics and organizing strategy you're describing, will not go into any kind of coalition work with an organization that explicitly calls for a cutoff of military aid to Israel until there's an end to the occupation. So what kind of pressure do you have in mind?
Well, the reason I think people in BritCitic, at least the organization as a whole, and J Street don't believe in cutting off military aid to Israel is because Israel has legitimate security fears and legitimate security concerns. And preventing it from having the defensive weaponry that it needs to stand up to Hamas rockets and to stand up to, frankly, the terrorist groups that are still bound and determined to blow up Israelis in supermarkets and shopping malls, I don't think American policy that tries to prevent and circumvent Israel's security concerns is a wise one. But there are other tactics and techniques that the American government can use to try to ensure that Israel, again, lives up to its promises. There's a whole chapter in my book devoted to Israelis who plead with the United States to take a different tack on this position, on this issue, than it's been taking up until now. So, for example, there needn't be an automatic American veto of everything that comes down the UN Security Council, as there is now, if it's against Israel. There needn't be American support for close Israeli ties to the EU, for example. There needn't be American happiness about every Israeli arms deal that it wants to make with other countries. There are things that American engagement can do that don't compromise the core security requirements of Israel, but nevertheless will send a signal to the Israeli people that we're not particularly happy about specific policies that Israel is engaged in.
Well, let's turn to another part of your book. You've described specific concerns you have about, I think, what you refer to as the far left who are engaged in this issue. Could you describe some of your concerns and why you think that the tack that's being taken by these far lefties isn't productive?
Let's go back to what needs to happen, I think, in the American political in the American political context. Like it or not, identity politics is an important part of the American political scene. And as I said before, right now, too many politicians believe the only Jews they need to care about are those who support the conventional Israel lobby. So to change that, politicians, the Obama administration needs to hear from and, frankly, get donations from American Jews whose identities are tied with Israel and want the U.S. to be more even-handed, more fair. Now, one of the things that prevents this second group from speaking out and getting more involved is the kind of rhetoric that one hears on a lot of radio stations, the kind of rhetoric that's being tossed around on campus by those who are explicitly and vociferously anti-Israel. Now, I agree with many of their objections to Israeli policy, but it's the way those objections are expressed and the ideological basis of those connections that I have problems with. And one of the problems with are not only because I object to them on the substance, but because they are discouraging, for example, American college students who would be the logical passionate moderates to speak out against certain Israeli policies. It's discouraging those folks from speaking out because they're afraid they're playing into the hands of those who don't want Israel to exist. They're playing into the hands of those who treat Israel as solely responsible for the status quo, which I don't believe to be the case. And they're playing into the hands of those who deny or completely ignore Israeli security concerns. By they, I mean the far left. And I think that a certain amount of circumspection is necessary, a certain amount of restraint is necessary in the kind of rhetoric that we're seeing on both college campuses and in the blogosphere in order for passionate moderates within my community to speak out more forcefully. Now, this is a free speech issue here, and I don't know how to solve it. Of course, people should have free rein to say what they want to say about the conflict. Of course, people should have every right to make their case if they believe that Zionism itself is racism, or if they believe that Israel is implementing policies that are genocidal. But there is something wrong with the kind of rhetoric that treats Israel, again, as the worst human rights abuser on the earth. And there is something wrong with the kind of rhetoric that denies Jews the same right to self-determination that every other people has. If those two sort of extremes of rhetoric are the main core of what we're hearing on American college campuses, for example, again, that does more harm than good ultimately to the Palestinian people that the far left is trying to help, because they're shaping a psychological reality that has a great impact on the political reality. And the last thing the Palestinian people right now are American activists who make Jews who oppose the occupation even more reluctant to speak out.
And we're talking to Dan Fleshler, who is author of Transforming America's Israel Lobby. He's going to be speaking here in Oregon later this month on two occasions. First on Saturday, December 19th at 7 p.m. at Congregation Neves Shalom. That's at 2900 Southwest Peaceful Lane here in Portland. And then again on Sunday, December 20th at 6:30 p.m. at Temple Beth Israel at 1175 East 29th Avenue down in Eugene. Mr. Fleshler, I want to pursue this whole question about the far left and moderate. I mean, these are words, these are highly ideological terms. One person's moderate is an apologist for Israel's policies. Another person's far leftist is someone who has a principled political stand. And I wonder, when you begin to use those kinds of terms, for example, you describe people who want to deny Jews the same right of self-determination as any other person. But I think at least among the people that I suspect you would refer to as far left, I've never heard that position. What I have heard is the demand that, for example, Palestinians and other non-Jews should have precisely the same rights as any other citizens, and I'm talking about citizens of Israel, as any other citizens in Israel. And right now, of course, that is clearly not the case. So in what respect, how can we begin to disentangle this notion of what is a far leftist and what is a moderate without actually getting down to the concrete issues?
Well, it's difficult to disentangle it. It's a very tricky question. I completely agree with those who believe that Palestinian citizens of Israel should have the same rights as Israeli Jews. I completely agree with those who say that the Palestinian people need to exercise the same aspiration for self-determination that the Jewish people do. But there are those who don't agree with that. There are those who simply think that for better or for worse, the entire enterprise of Zionism was corrupt, immoral, and depraved from the start. And even if they believe that, and even if that's true, therefore the Jewish state as it exists now should not exist. And that's going too far in my mind. It's one thing to say that the Palestinian state and the Jewish state should exist side by side in security and peace. It's quite another thing to say that the Jewish state cannot exist at all. And it's at that point where I think the distinctions have to be made between the far left and the kinds of passionate moderates and the liberal left that I support.
Again, we're speaking with Dan Fleshler. We only have about a minute left, and I want to let you, Mr. Fleshler, close with any comments or ideas that we haven't covered so far. Again, people will have an opportunity to talk with Mr. Flesher when he's here in Portland Saturday, December 19th, and again down in Eugene on the 20th. And hopefully we'll have you back on to continue this discussion, a very interesting discussion, I think, and one very worthwhile to have. Mr. Flesher, any closing comments for our listeners?
Well, within the community I know most about, within the American Jewish community, there's an understandable fear of having the American government lean on both sides of the conflict as opposed to just one side. And while I understand that fear, they need to understand that we've already seen the situation. We've already tried this experiment where both parties negotiate without an active American mediation. We know that it doesn't work to have an occupying power negotiate the terms of the relinquishment of its own occupation with an occupied people when the asymmetries of power are so large. And that's why, complicated and difficult as it is, people in my camp believe that the United States needs to have much more political wiggle room and leeway to do what both peoples need. And in order to do that, there has to be a much more balanced American approach to the conflict. And that's kind of where I'm coming from. It's in the interest of Israel, it's in the interest of the Palestinian people, it's in the interest of the American people for this kind of policy to take hold in the region. We haven't seen it yet. We've seen hints of it from the Obama administration. And what I'm interested in is seeing much more of the kind of active, proactive, and creative engagement that the American government has shown in the past and might be able to show in the future if it got enough political support, both from the American Jewish community, but also from the Christian community, the Muslim community, the atheist community, and if everyone is involved in this, everyone has a stake in this conflict, and everyone needs to start speaking out about it.
Thank you very much, Mr. Flesher, author of Transforming America's Israel Lobby, The Limits of Its Power and the Potential for Change. And you've been listening to a KABU Public Affairs special program, Focus on Israel-Palestine. I'm William Seaman. Thanks for tuning in.